The House Committee on Revenue for March 31st, 2009 will come to order. We'll open a work session on House Bill 2067. Colleagues, as you recall, this is the ongoing discussion that we're having on the reform involving the administration of tax credits. And we have a number of amendments that were, two amendments, I guess, that were passed out to you. The biggest one you got yesterday. And I think Chris and Representative Jules are ready to talk about those, and I hope the other committee members are. I don't expect this bill to move today. We don't have the fiscal. We don't have the revenue estimate. And we're still waiting for an opinion from Ledge Council. But we hope to have those tomorrow. So why don't you two talk a little about these two amendments, and let's see if other members have comments.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Colleagues, you'll see the dash ones and the dash twos. As we discussed briefly yesterday, the dash one establishes the regular sunset period at six tax years, beginning with the initial tax year, and the dash twos is the larger amendment that works through all of the existing tax credits that both that have existing sunsets as well as those that have no sunset in statute, and reorganizes them according to the subject areas that you have on your sheet entitled Oregon Tax Credits with the yellow highlights. There is a new version says HB 2067-2 amendment parentheses Oregon tax credits.
Okay, so it's the same, looks the same, but it's got a different title.
Different title.
Okay, and that was passed out today, wasn't it?
Yes.
Yeah. It's in your pile, and it's covered with a sheet that looks like that.
And the major difference, Mr. Chair, colleagues, between those two versions is that in looking through the dash two amendments, the fire insurance tax credit that was in the previous version categorized under community services, education, housing with a sunset date of 2016, because it is a subsection of the same section of statute that relates to the workers' compensation assessments, they were assigned from Legislative Council the same proposed sunset date. So now both of those are in the environment, agriculture, business category with a proposed sunset date of 2014. So that's the major substantive change between the two versions. Colleagues, you'll also note per Representative Reed's question yesterday about shortening some of the sunset periods, you'll note that none of the credits that have sunsets imposed upon them will have a sunset that is shorter than the six tax years that will be imposed under the dash ones. So even in this first cycle, none of the tax credits will have a sunset that is any shorter than future cycles for the sunsets of the tax credits. So, Mr. Chair, members, that's the major effect of the dash ones and dash twos. Chris, did you have anything you wanted to add to that?
I think I got it covered.
Right. Okay. Questions or comments today? I'm hoping that we can move this bill very soon, depending upon when we get the required reports back. And so today is a great time, if you've got questions or concerns, to raise them. Representative Broom.
Well, just a procedural question, Mr. Chair. Is it your intent to perhaps move these amendments, but not move the... I know you're not going to move the bill today, but are you trying to adopt the amendments today?
No.
Not necessarily.
What we're going to ask for a fiscal and revenue forecast based on the assumption that these two amendments are adopted. Obviously, if they're not, then we have to do something else. But that's my plan for probably tomorrow. This is being one of those bills with a lot of details in it. We have to go at it sort of stepwise. Anything else this morning? I assume everyone's had a chance to take a look at the amendment.
Yes, Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, I might just add to a question that came up, I think, the first time that we discussed this bill from Representative Bentz about what is the purpose of the tax credits and how are we approaching these. In our discussions, we really identified sort of three categories of what the tax credits are intended to achieve, and just in a very broad sense. There are those that are intended to induce a behavior, whether for an individual or an organization or a business. And then there are ones that, the second category is ones that are intended to compensate for an expense incurred by an individual or business that society has an interest in taking a public share of that expense. And then the third category are tax credits that are fundamental to the structure of our tax system in order to ensure an efficient and fair functioning of the tax system, such as the personal exemption credit. And they're not intended to compensate or induce behavior. So the third credit, the third category of tax credits are the ones on your second page where it says no sunset suggested, that we have removed the third category from the sunset language because that third category of credits are those that appear to be fundamental to the functioning of the tax system, as opposed to a credit in the sense that we think of the others.
Representative Berger.
Remind me again, the yellow highlighting is...
Mr. Chair, Representative Berger, the yellow highlighting are the credits that were in the original 2067 bill.
Okay. Got it. And this is in addition to.
That's
okay.
Correct.
Right. When we, in our conversation, decided we wanted to expand the coverage of the bill, and that's what led us to the others.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. Anything else for today on this bill? All right. Well, with that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 2067, and I'll announce, colleagues, that it is my intention to reopen this tomorrow in hopes of passing it out. We'll see whether we actually have the paperwork done tomorrow or not, but that's the plan. We'll open the work session on House Bill 3411. Are you on that one, too? Yeah, okay. Where are we on 3411?
House Bill 3411 is the one that makes modifications to the business energy tax credit. And at the last discussion on this bill last week, there were a handful of amendments that were the result of a couple of memos from Mike Braney from the Department of Energy. Those have been requested, and Ledge Council is working on those. We don't have the language back yet.
Ah, okay. And this was based on Mr. Graney's memo from what date?
There were three memos. One dated March 13, and the March 13 memo. In it had three points. The first point is essentially what is in House Bill 3411 as drafted. Mm-hmm. The other two points were disallowing the extra 10% cost overrun from the pre-cert to the final cert, pulling that out, and then reducing the maximum certified cost per project from $20 million down to $10 million. Mm-hmm. Those were from the March 13 memo, and then there were two memos dated on March 19th, and one of them would add to the renewable manufacturing facilities credit, facilities that produce electric vehicles or electric vehicle components, so that would be an expansion of the manufacturing facility credits, because right now that credit only applies to renewable energy. This would open it up to manufacturers of electric vehicles.
Ah, right.
And then the fourth one was from a memo also dated March 19th, and it dealt with incorporating into the calculation of the credit the grants received from the Energy Trust, kind of pulling those out from the calculation of the credit. So the certified costs that go into the determination of the credit, any grants received from the Energy Trust would be pulled out.
Yeah, and this is the This was the meeting I missed last week. Do we have amendments being prepared on the basis of these memos?
Yes, those four have been requested, so those amendments are being drafted. And then there was also another amendment being drafted, I believe in response to some questions Mr. Bentz had. I'm referring to,
from who?
Representative Bentz.
Bentz,
right. Yeah. And House Bill 3411, Section 2, Sub 2A, lines 12 and 13 on page 1 of the bill, the language reads, the applicant has complied with all state and local requirements for licenses and permits required for the facility. There is a question of whether or not all of those permits could actually be achieved before the pre-certification. So there's language being drafted to the effect of that the applicant has requested the permits in order to get the pre-certification, and that in order to get the final certification, they have actually completed the permit process.
Important little steps.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. Since that last meeting, I've had contact from two groups that wanted to be heard on this bill to talk about issues involving, let me just say it this way. One of them is the rural electric distribution companies. And Paul, you have somebody you wanted to be heard today. And then we also have AFL-CIO with some ideas. Is someone there here from? Yes. Okay. So why don't we hear from those two? They're talking about completely different topics, but let's hear from them this morning, and we'll decide where we want to go with those ideas. And we'll hear from them first, and then you can come up. Yeah.
If he agrees with us, he can come
up. Oh, and apparently the county commissioners wanted to comment as well. Is there someone here representing the county commissioners? Yeah, okay. So you come up in a minute. Thank you. Yes, sir. Gentlemen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm here with Kevin Owens, who's from the Columbia River People's Utility District. And I'm an attorney in Portland. And we represent the People's Utility Districts Association, OPUDA, Oregon People's Utility District Association. And we're here to talk about the Betsy and how it applies in certain circumstances relating to energy, power, electricity. And Kevin's going to talk about it a little bit. I thought I'd preface it a little bit with just sort of a basic primer on the Commerce Clause, because there are some questions out there on what exactly you can or cannot do under the United States Constitution, the Commerce Clause. For those of you who are not familiar with the Commerce Clause, basically, when the states were joined, one of the problems out there was we didn't want 13 or whatever it was as we grew, 13 separate jurisdictions on everything where they basically set up tariffs to block everybody else's goods from coming across. So what we have is a Commerce Clause in the United States Constitution, which is probably more important for its negative, what's called the negative Commerce Clause. It basically means that one state cannot burden the commerce coming into it from another state. In fact, probably a great case, in case you get really bored at night and want to read some legal cases, is Westland Creamery versus Healy. It's a 1994 case out of the U.S. Supreme Court. And it basically says that the negative aspect of the Commerce Clause prohibits economic protectionism, that is, regulatory measures designed to benefit in-state economic interests by burdening out-of-state competitors. In other words, you can benefit your in-state stuff, but you can't burden. The classic example is you cannot set up a discriminatory tax rate, not to bring up any other issue. You cannot set up a discriminatory tax rate that treats out-of-state interests differently than in-state interests. But you can spend your money the way you want to. In effect, you can subsidize industries in-state and subsidize things that help people in-state. A classic example is tuition. You have in-state tuition and out-of-state tuition. You're providing education. You're basically saying that those who are in-state are paying a lesser tuition than those who are out-of-state. It's done quite a bit. What we are talking about is when power, and Kevin will get into this, when power is sold, or say wind power gets the BETC tax credit of 50%, the power is sold out of state, and then we have to go out and buy it back from out of state. It's very expensive. Our power rates are very low here in Oregon. There should be, and what we would advocate for, is a difference between power that stays in-state and power that stays that goes out-of-state. In other words, why not have something that is a 50% tax credit for that stays in-state and actually benefits the people whose money you are spending to do this versus a 35% tax credit, for example, for that which goes out-of-state, which is not really benefiting us at all. And having said that, I would turn it over to Kevin to kind of walk you through what we're talking about.
Thank you, Paul. As Paul indicated...
And for the record, would you state your name,
yes,
please?
I will. Chairman Barnhart, representatives. My name is Kevin Owens, and I'm the general manager of Columbia River PUD in St. Helens, Oregon. I'm here on behalf of the Oregon People's Utility District Association as the chair of their legislative committee. OPUDA is comprised of six PUDs here in the state of Oregon. We serve about 115,000 customers. We deliver 4.2 million kilowatt hours to those customers. And we are operated and have five elected board members that oversee the operation of each of those PUDs. They they are held to open meetings laws, establish policies, and set cost-based rates through local control. The PUDs, I think it's important to understand, the PUDs provide about 416 family wage jobs in the rural communities of Oregon and paid out more than $33 million in wages last year. We also pay property taxes and franchise fees to the cities and counties where we serve. That amounted to about $7.4 million last year. The PUDs provide clean energy as a result of the federal-based hydro system, which is a clean, renewable energy resource that Oregonians benefit from. Power delivered to Oregon PUDs in this year, 2009, 81% of our power supply this year comes from clean, renewable hydropower off the Columbia River system. Another 10% is provided by the Columbia Generating Station. What that means to our customers that over 90% of our power supply that we're delivering to customers this year is coming from a resource with no carbon footprint or produces greenhouse gases. In addition to this clean resource, we're not sitting back on our laurels and saying that's good enough. All the PUDs in this state are actively developing additional renewable energy resources that includes cogeneration, wood waste, biomass, agricultural waste, landfill gas, fish-friendly hydro, and PUDs continue to develop and invest in these renewable resources for the future, and that includes wind as well as wave energy. PUDs continue to offer innovative energy solutions relying on renewable projects, energy efficiency programs, and conservation as a resource. In 2008 alone, over $3.5 million was provided to our customers for energy efficiency and conservation programs. Oregon utilities have been leaders in the nation with efficiency and conservation acquisition strategies. We are continuing to work with residential, commercial, and industrial customers to capture these opportunities and put Oregonians back to work. Energy and efficiency and conservation are an important source for lowering dependence on electricity generation in the future and reducing our power supply costs. I was before you on February 19th of this year regarding House Bill 2472 and am back here today with you to remind you that Oregon PUDs encourage this committee to give thoughtful consideration to any bill that makes changes to the business energy and tax credit to ensure that that investment made by Oregonians through the BETC program provides for the greatest return of investment to Oregonians. Oregon's Betsy has proven to be a very viable tool for independent power producers, investor-owned utilities, as well as us consumer-owned utilities that continue to develop these resources, renewable resources, in the state of Oregon. We do believe, however, that changes are necessary to improve the applicability of the Betsy, to align the Betsy, as it's currently written, with 2007 RPS legislation and provide a true benefit to Oregonians that are financing these projects. We do not object to the changes to improve the program. In fact, we encourage changes that would require benchmarks and other economic criteria be met to ensure a fair rate of return to Oregonians. The Department of Energy has made recommendations that will improve the program, but unfortunately they fall short. Oregon taxpayers are financing renewable development in this state, and the changes made to the Betsy in 2007 made them 50% investors in projects that receive these Betsys. I think you're all aware of the February 2nd report by Eco Northwest titled Economics of Oregon Energy Tax Credit Programs, and chronicles the net benefits over and above what it might have been achieved had the Betsy tax credits not been in place, and that those tax dollars reallocated to other government agencies. Unfortunately, what is lost in the dialogue and analysis that these projects produce energy to consumers long after the economic benefits of construction jobs are realized by counties. I'm kind of the silent voice in the back corner of the room that goes beyond looking at these projects as an economic driver for the cities and counties out there. These produce a product. We're not building office building and retail strip malls. They actually have a long life to them that I'm interested. Electric utilities in Oregon are interested in that output. And that seems to be lost in the dialogue when we get so obsessed with the economic impact of these projects. Affordable power supply drives the economic engine in rural counties we serve. We believe Oregon taxpayers deserve a greater return on their investment that clearly benefits Oregonians. A preliminary review of wind projects financed by the Betsy reveals that the output has been sold to utilities in other states. I brought you a press release at the previous time I came before the committee that highlighted a 10-year purchase between the Bonneville Power Administration and Pacific Gas and Electric in San Francisco to recall energy that was produced with Betsy tax credits in the state of Oregon by Oregon taxpayers and recalled by Bonneville to serve customers here in the Northwest that had been sold out of state to Pacific Gas and Electric. It naturally came back at a premium. I brought you another example. This is reality. The Shepherd's Flat project in eastern Oregon was developed by DCE, an affiliate of New York's Caithness Energy. On August 18, 2008, Southern Cal Edison signed a 20-year contract for the output of Shepherd's Flat, 909 megawatts of wind generation out of the state that was financed by Oregon taxpayers. The only way this energy is returned to Oregonians during its contract term is for it to be repurchased by Oregon utilities, naturally. With the application of the 50% Betsy, much of that energy was financed by our taxpayers and returned to them at a higher cost, as I mentioned earlier. This business model is seriously flawed, and I guess the challenge is whether you want to be enablers of that economic model that allows a New York company to come in and get financed 50% on a project and sell it out of state when there's a need for utilities here in the state, as mandated by the RPS, to use the output of those facilities. To illustrate a further disconnect with the current law, all Oregon utilities, investor-owned as well as consumer-owned utilities, are now subject to the renewable portfolio standards that the state adopted in 2007. In addition to that, all public preference customers, consumer-owned utilities in the Northwest, Oregon as well, are now required to provide 100% of their power supply for growth in their utility service areas beyond 2011. So we're going to get our piece of the Bonneville system as public preference customers, but everything in the future, we're required to acquire new power supply resources. So we're looking on that. We're all actively involved in that. I mentioned some of the renewable projects that we're already looking at. The state is in a financial crisis, facing up to $3 to $4 billion revenue shortfall. You're in a unique position to find new and additional revenue sources for the state while promoting noble goals such as furthering climate change mitigation measures, which includes investments in renewable energy. The investment in renewable energy to meet these goals should result in a return to Oregonians that is equal to or greater than their original investment. At a time when all Oregon electric utilities are moving to provide new future power supplies, most of which will be from new renewables, taxpayers are subsidizing these projects that sell their output to utilities outside the state. We are looking to create and acquire affordable resources through efficiency, conservation, and renewable energy development like everybody else in the state without further burdening Oregonians with increased electricity bills. Electricity drives the economic engine in our rural communities. It's very, very important. So if anything comes on the horizon that looks like it might increase our rates or whatever, we're going to stand up for it and analyze it very carefully. If the state is in the business of helping to develop a renewables market in Oregon, it only makes sense that Oregon utilities, charged with integrating more renewables, should be the natural beneficiary of resources to deliver to Oregon customers. If not, the Betsy is simply subsidizing the exportation of renewables leaving Oregon with a limited number of new jobs and revenue. While the Betsy has been effective in creating new renewable resources, Oregon PUDs feel that the committee should amend the Betsy to include a lower financial incentive to projects whose power output is sold outside the state of Oregon. Oregon taxpayers finance these projects, and Oregon utilities are bound by Oregon law to deliver renewable energy to their customers. Oregon taxpayers deserve a greater return on their investment. Oregon PUDs, as Paul mentioned earlier in his preface to my testimony, mentioned that there should be some consideration in the incentives provided to these projects that continuation of the 50% Betsy tax credit for those projects that keep their energy within the state for Oregonians that invested into these projects, and it should be reduced if these developers sign long-term power supply contracts to sell it to California. We have an RPS in the state that you adopted in the 2007 session. It requires all electric utilities, or the major large ones anyway, that require 25% of their power supply portfolio come by renewables by 2025. There's graduated hurdles in that process. What's important to realize is the market dynamics. To the south of us in California, they're way ahead of the curve on this. They have hurdles of 20% by 2010 and 33% by 2020. You can see that the market dynamics or whatever, they're going to grab anything and everything they can early to supply that need down line. So that's why a lot of these power contracts, which are typically 10 to 20 years long, are being signed down to California to prepare for inevitability to meet legal mandates or state law in California. So just to add a qualifier for that, we would like to see these amendments added in to this bill in consideration of what Mike Graney has offered with his amendments, that continuation of the 50% credit for those projects that sell the output of their projects inside the state. But in consideration of how utilities work and how we forecast power supply nodes, I think there needs to be a benchmark there as well, is that we're always forecasting our power needs 5-10 years out in the future as we're preparing for 2011 right now. I think there needs to be some consideration in this that we invest in projects and we may not have immediate need for them. So I think the only caveat or amendment to that I might offer is that if these developers sign power contracts, short-term power contracts, in contrast to long-term contracts, which are 10 years and beyond, they should be allowed to receive the full 50% Betsy tax credit if they entered into short-term power supply contracts less than 10 years in that 5 to 10 period, just basically to balance their power supply portfolio until they actually need it. So there needs to be consideration of how we forecast loads and acquire resources that shouldn't be hampered by that. So there is a little bit of a difference in understanding short-term contracts versus long-term contracts. That concludes my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Owens. Questions? Yes, Representative Brune.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Owens, thank you for your testimony. This goes out to maybe you or to you, Paul. Help me understand. because I don't. Help me understand what makes energy production a different traded sector industry than the other things that we subsidize in one way or another, that we use the SIP program for, you know, with Intel, numerous other companies, and high tech and life sciences, all traded sector industries that we want to export. And we want it to be a net export business because we want those monies to come back and stay. Help me understand, because I think you'll try, the difference between energy production and any other sort of production.
Well, I think in this respect, I think we need to tie this together with the RPS mandate that was voted into law, or whatever that you put into law in 2007, that the left hand of government has mandated us to acquire these renewable power supply to the extent of having 25% by 2025, and the other hand of government is allowing it to be financed by taxpayers and sent outside the state. So the left hand and the right hand need to get on the same page on this thing to understand that if we have statutory mandates on this side, you got to support us on this side and not let us get caught short or paying more for something that we subsidized right here in our state.
And if I might, Mr. Chair, Representative Bruhn, the difference between a manufacturing subsidy, say for an Intel or something like that. They're selling something it here, the money's coming back here. What you've done, there's sort of two aspects to this energy generation. Number one is the jobs and tax base benefit of creating, say, building out a wind farm. That's a great thing. You should encourage it. But after that's done, there's very little. You got a couple of people running around maintaining this stuff. The money that is flowing to whoever owns that project. It's not coming back to benefit you. What we're saying is, if you're going, you have to consider both aspects. Yes, it's great to subsidize the development of that project. We have no problem with it. But should you subsidize it additionally if it's going to other folks, or do you subsidize it because it's staying in Oregon? It has the additional benefit of staying in Oregon.
One follow-up.
Yes, please, go ahead.
Paul, thanks for that. So is this bottom-line criteria then jobs? I mean, because take the Intel example, thousands of jobs, thousands of mm-hmm. good jobs. Take a wind farm, not so many jobs, although when you take them in mass, it's many more, because it's certainly not where the ownership lies. I mean, Intel is not an Oregon company. It's somewhere else, and its stockholders are everywhere in the world. So it's not that there's an ownership interest. So is it just the jobs? Is that the bottom line?
Mr. Chair, Representative Bruhn, the jobs are a large part of it. Basically, if there's a continuing benefit, as there would be in your Intel example, to jobs created in the state of Oregon over a long period of time, that's great. That's a wonderful reason to give a subsidy. What we're talking about here is a scenario where you get considerably more benefit for the state of Oregon if the power stays within the state. Otherwise, the utilities that you've mandated to, in effect, acquire this power have to buy it back at a premium after it's been sold to another jurisdiction. It doesn't make sense to put us in that position. So what we're saying is, if you're going to, as you have, and mandated that we acquire this, then it's our money, the taxpayer money you're using. Maybe it's a good idea to use less of it if it's just the initial jobs and tax base. And you have to do it, maybe you do it by kind of energy project. Maybe there are projects that have considerably more long-term jobs than others. But if it's something that basically it gets built out and then it's maintained, maybe that's the kind of thing that you say, all right, you get 35% if you're going to sell it to California or Arizona or somebody else, and you get 50% if you're selling it within the state, because that's a continuing benefit, and we're going to use our Oregon tax dollars to benefit our Oregonian constituents.
Could I add to that, Paul, a little bit? That was, you know, I guess that's what I was trying to reference, that I think the jobs and economic benefits that go along with these projects are very, very important to the state right now, incredibly important, but they seem to be overshadowing that silent voice that I characterize in the back of the room, that these projects produce energy for 20 to 30 years, and I'm trying to speak up for somebody that needs that output, and the short-term economic benefits are great for the state in producing jobs and economic benefits and the long-term land leases that are involved. But we need to also take into consideration that these produce an output, and utilities in this state have a mandate to utilize that output. So we need to look beyond short-term into the long-term perspective of this. They're providing something very important to the state of Oregon.
Thank you. Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I wanted to make a statement and get your reaction to it. The difference between the electricity and shoes is that we don't sell shoes to California and buy them back at twice the price.
Well, we may. I don't know.
Not sure that's not the case.
We shouldn't.
Right, but
that's a very good analogy.
Yeah, you're illustrating, Representative, what you think is actually occurring in this situation, I think.
Well,
aren't you?
Pardon me?
Mr. Chair, Representative Riley, you haven't mandated that we buy shoes.
Right.
And if you mandated that we bought shoes, we're mandated to buy renewable resources, which is a good thing. That's a great thing. We're not complaining about it. It's just you're sort of saying, all right, you have to do it, but we got you here because we're going to use your money to build this stuff out, and it's going to be sold down to other places, and then you have to go out and buy it on the secondary market, bring it back. It's just seems to be a little bit illogical.
Representative Berger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Gentlemen, we're talking about the production side. What about the pricing side? If we say, okay, you only get 50% on this project because you're selling it in Oregon and 35% on this project that you're selling in California, you still could pay. The argument could be made, oh, but we're getting less Betsy, so therefore the power that you're buying is more expensive, and you're back to the same high cost of power. Do you understand what I'm saying? If power price is what you're trying to get at, does this get you there?
I think following your logic, Representative Berger, is that that would benefit Oregonians. If you're providing a higher incentive and buying down the cost of those projects in the state of Oregon, they're going to have a lot lower production cost. Going outside the state and getting a lesser incentive, 35% or whatever, is going to impact their economics, but that's over a 20, 30-year lifetime that they're financed over. So, and when you ship them out of state, they're going to increase cost as well because there's additional transmission costs and load shaping costs involved in that when you ship it out of state versus within your own control area.
I guess I'm not. When we got into this RPS thing, it bothers me a lot, exactly the problems that you brought up. We are mandating on one side that you have to buy this, so we're subsidizing it in order to make you buy it. And we're soon going to get into these price wars over energy. And I don't like the slippery slope at all. And I think you've pointed out a fundamental flaw in our whole RPS system. And I appreciate you bringing this forward. I'm not sure if I agree with your proposal, but I appreciate you bringing this forward as a real issue when we go to mandate where you get your power. If I plug in my appliance, Mr. Chair, excuse me for ranting a bit, if I plug in my appliance, I want my appliance to work, and I'm less crazy about paying extra for it because of some government mandate on exactly how that power was derived. I think we've put some real problems into our energy system, and it's going to come back to haunt us very soon, and you can just nod and you don't have to respond.
I don't believe Mr. Marmain can resist.
Well, let's see.
Let's see.
Right. I'll be quiet.
Representative Call.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mine's more of a comment just because I still have my confusion about the whole issue is I don't know what purpose we're trying to get at with the Betsy. Are we trying to create renewable energy? Are we trying to create renewable energy for consumption within the state of Oregon? Are we trying to create jobs? And which one of those is of primary importance? And depending on where you set that, you come to a different point. I think what you have to offer, Paul, is very thoughtful and intelligent. If we're deciding the primary goal of the Betsy is to create renewable energy for consumption in Oregon. I think that underlies all of the comments that have been made up here today, all of the questions that have been asked, is I don't know that there's any consensus about what the Betsy is supposed to be doing, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on that.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, your dilemma is it's an interesting dilemma. What are you trying to do with this? I couldn't resist. I have to get back to Representative.
My body starts shaking.
I really thought he'd make it two questions.
The problem is that there's a disconnect in a lot of stuff you're doing, and I know when the chair and I and Danelle talked yesterday, the disconnect was very apparent. It's like we do a number of these different things, and how does it all fit together? What are we doing? We have a bid over here, the RPS. We have Betsy over here. We are doing these things. And what you're doing with it, encouraging job promotion and tax-based development and all that stuff, it's great. It's wonderful stuff. Now, is there a way to sort of make it holistic? What is the way to kind of tie it all together that makes real economic sense if you're going to be spending my money as a taxpayer? And what makes really sense, a lot of sense, is if you have an RPS, and we do, so it's kind of 2 years ago that fight was over, we have the RPS, we're dealing with that. So now, how do we best, in effect, comply with that? And is it smart? Yes, it's smart to help people develop these renewable projects. Absolutely agree. You may have to look at these renewable projects on, do they produce long-term continuing jobs, as in manufacturing, or do they produce short-term jobs with other benefits? Are we burdening Oregonians, in effect, by selling the power out of state and then requiring us to buy it back from out of state? Those are all questions that you, because you ran for this job, get to decide. We are just pointing out the problems, and we think, frankly, after discussing it, that the best way to handle this is to have a differential on dependent on where the power is, in effect, being used. And if the power is being used to benefit Oregonians, and it's our tax dollars that are paying for that, then that's great.
Mr. Chair, Representative Call, I just wanted to comment also that I think your point is right on target, exactly what you asserted here, whatever, that peace parting, trying to put Band-Aids on the Betsy to make it work is not the correct approach. If you peace part it, put Band-Aids on it, trying to fix it, you're going to be revisiting this again and again and again. The point of my testimony, as Paul illustrated here, we need to step back and take a holistic approach and really see what we're trying to achieve and take all these factors into place rather than just breaking them apart and trying to address them individually.
Thank you. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I haven't been in this institution long, but holistic and legislative don't fit.
it's definitely has religious overtones.
Right. Hopeful, wishful.
So it definitely doesn't.
Improbable. I am just curious about...
Is that the religious overtones? Heaven's coming down.
I'm just curious. The small number between 50% and 35% doesn't seem to me to be very meaningful when you compare it to a 30-40-year contract. And it seems to me that there's a lot of wishing going on that would make a difference when someone's sitting down to make a deal with California. And this is Representative Berger's thought. And I just wonder if the solution you're suggesting really gets us to where we want to go. So you can comment on the size of the change. I'd be interested on a $10 million deal, how many dollars that really is.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bentz, the power supply contracts may be in a 10 to 20 year window, but as far as these projects are actually receive considerable federal production tax credits, when you get to actually financing these projects, it's they run out, those production tax credits run out in 10 years. So they're typically financed for 10 years or less, not 20 years. So that difference of 50 and 35% over a 10-year period is a little more meaningful when you're talking about $20 million projects.
Yep. Yeah, please.
I think one of the proposals is to reduce the credit down to $10 million, maybe $11 million. Mm-hmm. And the share of that would be reduced on your proposal by some amount. Mm-hmm. And if you compare that to the amount of money that these contracts go for each one, it's minuscule.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, that's what I'm asking you. I'm just wondering how much you're really talking about in proportion to the actual value of the contract.
I don't have a thoughtful response on that as far as giving you an actual number on that.
Representative Bruin?
Oh, thank you again, Mr. Chair. Help me understand how this would be, two-part question, how this would be done logistically, and even in your last comment there, you talk about these long-term power contracts, which is easier for me to get my arm around how you handle this logistically. Are we saying, and once again, this is my ignorance of how wind power is sold and purchased, but it seems to me if you had those long-term contracts, that's easy enough to manage with a 35-50 sort of split. But if you're truly, and this is my understanding, if you're truly buying and selling power to meet demand shifts and fluctuation shifts on sort of an open market commodity basis, it seems to me this would be an impossible system to manage to have two different points, price points, if you will. And my second follow-up question to that is, does this create an opportunity when you have a differential to game the system? Could I, as a purchaser in California, come in and buy it as establish a shell corporation in Oregon to buy this power and then do whatever I want with it, if you will, including send it over the border? Once again, it obviously highlights my ignorance a little bit about mm-hmm. how electricity is bought and sold, how power is generated, but can you address it?
Mr. Chair and Representative, I think that all gets flushed out in the rulemaking. All of this stuff, when you get into cap and trade, and a lot of the things, as we have learned in the energy industry, can be open to loopholes and gaming. And I think in the rulemaking and considerable thought in when you develop these rules, whatever tries to close those up as much as possible. And make it legitimate transactions. Most of these investments, when a developer goes out and builds a 900-megawatt wind farm, you know what the credit market is right now. Nobody's lending money unless you've got a power supply contract to back that up. So nobody's lending money to do daily trades in the market to supply in that basis. Before anybody's going to get money lent to them, you better have a 10 to 20 year contract written up and to present to your investor. So I just don't think the market's there for that.
Okay. Others? A couple of things that I'm interested in. It sounds to me as though one of the things you're trying to do is to insulate the Oregon market from the more general market forces. California is obviously a huge draw for power, and they will pay a higher price than you would have to pay if the power was only available to be sold in Oregon. I mean, the market in Oregon is smaller.
Mm-hmm.
One presumes there's less demand, and therefore prices would be lower if there was a limitation on where a seller could sell power. And that's part of what I'm hearing. Is that a reasonable way of looking at that from where I'm sitting or not? And if not, how have I missed it?
Mr. Chair, let me
affect your voter.
Be sure we are not proposing that you limit where somebody can sell
their power. That.
That would be a violation of the Commerce Clause. What you are doing is saying we're going to give you taxpayer dollars depending on where, and our taxpayer dollars based on where it's going, because we're going to help out Oregonians, which is something you can do.
But isn't the object of this to achieve a lower price for this renewable energy if it's sold to an Oregon utility?
That's the bottom line. I mean, that's I'm looking out for what I have to pay for power supply
right.
to my customers, and I don't want to pay a premium for it if it's sold. If I've subsidized it through my tax dollars and sent it to California and paying a premium to bring it back. And I think the latitude that you provide these developers for short-term contracts or whatever, I think is a reasonable compromise rather than locking it into
right,
if
now
they sell anything out.
Right, now we're talking about details of how we get there.
Right.
But now I'm interested in the more general concept. Yes.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, you do this, I mean, with the university system right now. I mean, basically sure. you've made a decision that Oregonians are going to pay less than somebody from California who's
right.
coming up here or Hawaii or some other place. So you have tuition difference. You're investing, in effect, you're saying we're going to spend money, Oregonian money, Oregon money, taxpayer dollars, to help subsidize, in effect, Oregon students who are at the university. It's the same thing that we're talking about. You're going to say we're going to spend Oregon dollars. There's two aspects. One is the jobs, so we're going to spend Oregon money to create the jobs, and then we're going to, the other part of it is where the power is being used. We're looking long term, and that's what we're talking about.
Thank you. One other thing is, do you have the capability of preparing a worksheet to answer Representative Mentz's question about what the actual value of this kind of an inducement would be, and whether or not it would have any effect on the behavior of companies building wind systems? Is that something that you can do or that you know other people who can do it and get back to us quickly?
Mr. Chair, I think that's something we can certainly make an effort at.
I mean, is the correct number 35% versus 50? Is it 0 versus 50? Is it 15 versus 50? Or is it something else? Or is this just a bad concept and it won't work? I mean, I don't. If it's simply a bad concept and it won't work, we probably mm-hmm. shouldn't subsidize wind power at all, because they can build wind machines in Oregon and sell the power in California without a subsidy and do just fine. But a worksheet that sort of details how these numbers fit together with long-term contracts would be very, very helpful, I think, in answering Representative Bence's question. And I think without it, we're just playing with numbers out of the sky.
Right. Mr. Chair, we'll put together the information for you and bring it back to you as quickly as we can. I think we can do that, but we would never bring you something
Thank you.
that doesn't make sense.
I have two other quick questions. The first one is, I appreciate that very much. Thank you.
Speaking on your behalf or my behalf?
On my client.
That was the royal we.
It was. I have two other quick topics. I understand, I have been told, I don't know if this is true, that all of the likely wind generation sites in eastern Oregon, at least, have been optioned or leased. Do we know whether that's true or not?
I can't tell you whether that's true or not. I know that what they forecast for the future wind generation out of the Columbia Gorge in Oregon, if you look, is something in the order of 7,000 to 8,000 megawatts. So if they've optioned those properties, that's a lot of acreage that's been optioned. I find it hard to believe personally.
Okay.
Because that's what they're forecasting the potential is out there, and what Oregon needs is 7,000 to 8,000 megawatts.
And this is a question for Westland Creamery, I think. Is there any reason why California couldn't subsidize the development of wind power on these wind sites in Oregon?
Mr. Chair, there is no reason. You couldn't set up a different tax rate. For example, if you had wind farms in Oregon and wind farms in California, and you were going to tax the energy produced by both of them, you couldn't say, we're going to tax Oregon at X and California power at X plus 1. You can't do that. But you can spend your money any way you want.
Okay. And similarly, I assume that if we made appropriate changes to the state law, the state of California could subsidize tuition for California students at the University of Oregon if they wanted to.
Mr. Chair, if they choose to do so.
In fact,
when I first went to school to Eugene, University of Oregon used to have a sweatshirt said University of California at Eugene.
Yeah,
because there were so many Californians.
I remember that very well. Other questions for these two? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you
very
Mr.
much.
Chair,
we appreciate
representatives.
It. AFL-CIO and the and the counties, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, Duke Shepherd with the AFL-CIO. I testified, I guess, around about a month ago on 2472. So some of these comments are in that context. Now that it looks like you're moving on to another bill dealing with the business energy tax credit, some of the previous testimony was about energy being a product, and I think to Representative Call's comment, that very well may be the case, but then again, as I understand it, there are a variety of projects receiving business energy tax credits that aren't about putting energy on the grid. And the justification for those tends to be, well, and it's great economic development. I think our look at this is, if it's going to be economic development, let's be explicit about it, and let's set some standards for what economic development we want to see. And for us, those would be job standards. Those would be having some kind of expectation for cost per job when you're putting large sums of money into projects. And for us, of course, we always like to see prevailing wage on the construction side. Now, I don't know what the amendment mix will look like that you're going to see from the agency, and we wanted to originally put these into the mix as ideas to drive the discussion forward in terms of really raising the bar. Obviously, I will also say our amendments for 2472 worked logically better because that bill contained a cap. So if you're going to have a cap and then you set standards and you prioritize under a cap, it works better. That said, I don't know where you're going to go. But generally, if you can take an approach to have some priorities that are, I will also say, in statute, less in rule, more clear from the legislature, that's something we would really love to see.
Thank you. And members, what you've just received are amendments to the other bill, which I understand are being redrafted for this one. Is that right?
That's what we would like to see.
Okay. Questions? Mr. Shepherd? Thank you very much.
Thank
counties? We have several other things to do this morning. I appreciate your attendance today, and let's keep it short. I think you've had a chance to talk, at least on the topic, before. I was expecting one, and I've got four, so let's be very, very brief.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve McClure, Union County Commissioner. I've been a county commissioner for almost 19 years. I want to take just a brief moment and give you the local perspective of a wind farm. Our developer started looking in Union County about 5 years ago, and I need to tell you that we considered a wind farm to be a windfall for Union County. And it's got four components to it. The first component is revenue. As you know, because of ballot measure 4750, we're limited on the increase of our property taxes. So that drives us to look at growth to really meaningfully increase our revenue from a local perspective. You take a wind farm like the one that came to Union County, has a value of about $208 million. We did a SIP. We gave up part of that value, but to Union County itself, this year, it means about $365,000. Our property tax to Union County is just a shade over $3 million a year, about 3.132. So it's a 10% increase to our revenue that's discretionary for the communities. That's hugely important from our perspective. Union County is not a big county. We're only about 25,000 people. Gives you that take on it, why it's important to us. The other thing is during the construction period, $15 million in a nine-month period came into our community. The rock, the concrete, the labor, all those parts, hugely important. Now, it's not long-term, but I can tell you that it was very important. I talked to the rock supplier who supplied the rock for this project, and I said, "How's it going, Mace?" He said, "Steve, I'm living the dream." You know, he was running 30 trucks, 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, you know. And this is a person that had struggled to make it work. It was really a mine for him. The other piece is the permanent jobs. You know, we hear that there's not many permanent jobs. Let me tell you, in a county with an unemployment rate of nearly 15%, 15 jobs mean something. And these are good jobs. These jobs come with benefits, you know, they're family wage jobs. we certainly appreciate those jobs. The last component that I'd like to talk about just briefly is the property owners. A lot of these wind farms are going on old cattle ranches, people that have struggled to maintain their way of life, and it's really going to be beneficial to a lot of property owners in our community. Just one more point that I would like to make. We're looking at probably another 400 megawatts. This one was 100 megawatts. This one was worth $360,000. You do the math on 400 megawatts. So these things are very, very important to us local communities, and we want to encourage, you know, the state to participate to help us get these out here on the local process.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Gary Thompson. I'm a Sherman County judge. I'm part of that mid-Columbia area where the windmills are being built. Currently, we have approximately 900 megawatts going out of Sherman County, of which approximately 300 by the end of this year is going to be PGE project, Bigelow Canyon, and I believe almost 90 to 100% of that power is going to Oregonians. It's not being shipped off to California. So when we start talking about shipping the power off to California, sure, some of it is going to California because they're paying the extra dollars. But really, it's also coming to Oregonians. And any one of these utilities has a chance to buy into these projects. So we're really trying to muddy up the water. Oregon wind regime is mediocre at best. With it, we've got a four-year window to do this for renewable energy in Oregon. After 4 years, all the power is going to be coming out of Wyoming and the whole Midwest as soon as they get the grid built for that area. And that's where a lot of that stimulus money from the federal government is going. It's going into the Midwest to do power lines to California, Las Vegas, and that area. So Oregon's got about 4 years, and then we're going to be done with renewable energy being built, specifically wind, in Oregon. So just trying to keep the things we've got right now so that we can get them built out, because it is definite. It's a definite help to rural Oregon. It's actually a godsend. It's put Sherman County. We had, like Steve, a $3 million budget for our tax base. We are receiving $6 million over the next 15 years in addition to what we have normally been receiving. So it's a real boon to the small county of 1,800 people. It's paying for a new school. It's paid for a brand new library. The library, we just commissioned it last week. The new school will probably be in the next 3 to 4 years. And I hate to see that money disappear. I also brought up my wind expert with me, Paul Wooden, and he's the one that helped me develop the programs that Sherman County has been doing. And I'll turn it over to him.
Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Paul Wooden. I'm the executive director of a Chapter 190 intergovernmental organization called Community Renewable Energy Association. Sherman County, Union County, and a number of other counties are members. There's a handout coming out now that you can look at that lists our full membership. Our mission is to support in Oregon a very different type of renewable project than what most people are familiar with, and that is community-based projects of 10 megawatts and below. And that charter covers things like wave energy, biomass, geothermal, small hydro, small wind, and other locally owned renewable projects. In the scheme of life in Oregon, 99% of all renewables is commercial wind on large scale. And our role is to make sure that the state doesn't lose sight of the fact that there are a lot of smaller projects that are also working to come into the grid. We understand the desire of the legislature to try and contain costs. We're not particularly pleased with the fact that Betsy is on the table, but we can understand the economics you're dealing with. I'm here today to talk to you about just two provisions within House Bill 3411 that I think have unintended consequences for the little projects that are trying to come online. We believe that 3411 is drafted with good intentions, but there are two provisions that have the potential to seriously damage or actually kill the small community renewable effort in Oregon. And they are, one, the reduction of Betsy by 50% from $20 million to $10 million. But even more damaging is a provision that was proposed on the 19th that if Energy Trust makes a contribution, the Betsy component is reduced by a like amount. A 50% reduction in Betsy for a large $200 million project equates to about 2.5% of the project cost. It's a reduction that the large developers won't like it, but on a percentage basis, it's relatively small. When you come down to a 20 megawatt or a $20 million small hydro project in an irrigation district, and you take that same cut, $20 million to $10 million, you have, in effect, caused a 50% reduction just because of the scale of size of the economics. So while it makes a lot of sense to you on a big one, you can save some money, you've got to understand the ramifications on these littler projects. It's way disproportional. The other piece is the Energy Trust of Oregon component. When a small project puts its finances together, it looks at the project cost, the cost of the turbines, the buildings, et cetera. It then adds in the benefits, federal tax credit program, business energy tax credit, the debt component, and it looks at the economics. If the project is in the black, Energy Trust does nothing for the project. The role Energy Trust provides is if the project is marginal, it looks good, but it's not quite there, Energy Trust gives the incremental amount to push it into the black. If you pass the proposal in 3411 where Betsy takes a haircut for an Energy Trust investment, you have, in effect, taken away the effectiveness of Energy Trust to bring projects into the state because all you're doing is swapping dollar for dollar. The intent is that the Betsy be there and Energy Trust provide any incremental amount. Please don't change that. Don Coates and Harmon Hildebrand are two farmers in Sherman County. They're about 10 miles apart. They have worked for a number of years now and put a lot of their family money into trying to bring together small 10-megawatt family-owned wind projects. I know that the Hildebrands in particular have spent well over $1 million of family farm money to get their project to the point where it can be built. They're counting on Betsy and they're counting on Energy Trust to make that happen. In Middle Fork Irrigation, Craig DeHart is the operations manager. They've had about 3.5 megawatts of projects now since the 80s. They are working hard to get an expansion on their irrigation system to allow them to bring in another megawatt and a half. Again, Greg is looking to Betsy and Energy Trust for some of the financing, and they've spent quite a bit of money getting there. Hood River County is working on a 10-megawatt wind farm that I'm helping them with. They're going through environmental siting now and civil engineering on roads. These are all projects that people have in work with the understanding that the programs that the state is providing is going to be there for them. Please don't cut the bottom out from it. I guess in conclusion, again, the issues from a community viewpoint is Reducing Betsy from $20 million to $10 million has a grossly disproportionate impact on little projects over the big ones. Please consider that. And please understand the role that Energy Trust and Betsy play. They are a supportive role. They're not an exclusive either-or role. We are in support of renewables in their totality, including large commercial wind. We understand your need to look at finances. I think it will not be all that popular with commercial groups, and I'm sure they will speak eloquently on their behalf. I just want to leave you with, don't lose sight of us little guys, because you can do an awful lot of damage right now. If you find you have to make modifications to Betsy, okay. But you might consider an exclusion on projects 10 megawatts and below, like you have already considered on solar and renewable manufacturing. The amount of dollars you're going to get out of us is very, very small, because there's small projects and there's not that many of them in mass. But you can literally change the economics to where you can't build them in Oregon. I gave you a handout. The last page of it is a map that probably most of you have seen. These are projects all around the state that are trying to get their feet on the ground. Some of them won't make it. Some of them have already been built, and a number of them are deep in the process. They represent probably every one of your constituencies, with maybe one or two exceptions. It spans the state. These are the ones that I'm trying to address. That's what I came with. If I could have one more minute on a different topic, I know you're running short on time, but there's been discussion about the California power issue, and I'd like to present a different perspective on it if I can.
Please.
We heard from a PUD today in St. Helens from their perspective. I think from mine there's a potential flaw in the logic, and I want to expand on a little bit. The perception is that if power is sold to California, it will be bought back here to meet state renewable portfolio standard requirements at a higher rate. That has not been our experience out in central and eastern Oregon. It's not an either-or situation. Caithness was brought up as an example of 900 megawatts being sold to California. Judge Thompson brought up PGE's, a Bigelow Canyon project being sold into Oregon. There is enough land, there is enough transmission, and there is enough power market to support Oregon's renewable energy standard. There is also more that can be used to go into California. Ever since I came here in the 70s, I came out of the aluminum industry. The Northwest has always sold power to California on the spring runoff when the power is abundant in the hydro system. And then we have always bought it back again in the wintertime when the flows are low and the heating costs are up in Oregon. So the idea of California and Oregon swapping power is something that's been institutional. I don't believe that California RPS is going to impact the economics of Oregon's renewable portfolio standard. I think we're going to have both. And you brought up the point that I believe there is no difference with Intel selling chips into Europe or Asia or cherry growers selling their product out of state or wheat farmers selling overseas. We're blessed with land, wind, and a market that we can make a revenue stream off of, and I see no downside to the state of Oregon for power leaving the state. We want to make sure we got our own, but I think we do. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel? Representative Berger?
Quick question from the Sherman County judge. You said you had 900 megawatts online now. What's the potential in Sherman County for growth? Realistically.
Realistically? Hopefully by the end of 2010, we'll have about 1,200 megawatts running, and there's possibly another 1,200.
The ground is
leased up.
Okay.
I'm sorry. Say that last thing again.
All the ground in the northern where the wind regime is leased up.
In Sherman County.
Thank you. That answers the question I asked another panel.
Yeah.
But other counties are still open.
Thank you. Others for this panel? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. All right. We've just received four amendments on this bill, and I want Chris to describe them for us so that you'll have an orientation as you review them. And I want to let you, those who may be waiting to know that we're going to hold the public hearing on House Bill 3291 over until tomorrow.
32? Okay.
That's the last item on our agenda today. So anyone who's here for that, I want you to know that we're holding that over until tomorrow. That's House Bill 3291, the public hearing. Chris, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the 3411-1 amendment is the one that reduces the project costs down, reduces it from $40 million to $20 million. The dash 2...
Well, that has the effect, doesn't it, of reducing the maximum subsidy to 10?
Correct.
Okay.
Right.
So thank you.
The 50% credit from $20 million down to $10 million.
Okay.
Yes. The dash 2... is the one that expands the renewable manufacturing facilities credit to electric vehicle manufacturers, and you can see that on page 5 where the electrical vehicles language is added, lines 6 through 9. The dash 3...
Yes, Representative Berger?
Just a little slower. I'm looking for it.
Yeah, sorry. This is a very large section, but the only change appears to be... number changes at the very bottom, but then the boldface on the top of page 5.
Yeah. Okay.
Then the dash 3 amendment is the one pertaining to the grants from the Energy Trust, and the effect of that is remove, if a grant is received from the Energy Trust, that amount is removed from the certified costs, which are the basis for the credit. So that has an effect of reducing the credit.
So, in other words, half of the amount of the Energy Trust money would be reduced.
Mm-hmm. For 50% credit.
Right.
Yes.
So.
The.
Senator Berger?
Go through it again. Let me figure it out. Okay.
I'm sorry.
Run through it. Say it again.
You have the certified cost for the project.
Mm-hmm.
And the credit is 50% of the certified cost.
Mm-hmm. Betsy.
Right. So you have the grant from the Energy Trust. Right now, that is not subtracted from the certified cost. So what the dash 3 amendment would do, you have the certified cost for the projects, you subtract the trust, the grant from the Energy Trust, say it's $100.
Above the line.
Right. And then that has the effect of reducing the credit by $50. For the 50% credit.
Got it. I think.
Chris, can I have a follow-up question? This is maybe we can discuss this. How often are these Energy Trust grants being granted to the particular projects the wind projects we're talking about?
Excellent questions that we'll have to look at before we consider this amendment. Yeah. And then the last one,
the dash 4 amendment. Is the one that you'll see the key language there on page 2, line 19 and 20, and it's a deletion of language. Currently, when the projects go for pre-certification, there's an estimate of the cost, and by the time the final certification comes around, if for the credit, if the costs exceed the preliminary certification by 10%, then that 10% is also allowed a credit. This simply removes that extra 10% so that the only amount of the credit is the original estimate in the pre-certification. And it's the deletion of that language on lines 19 and 20 on page 2.
Do you want to ask questions today from Mr. Graney? I think these are amendments that he has proposed. Do you have questions for him? Representative Bailey.
Mr. Chair, just clarifying, question for Chris. So the earlier amendments that we received that were originally for Hospital 2472. They're now intended for 3411. I believe these are amendments that were put forward by AFL-CIO. We should ignore the dash 2, dash 3 on these. These will be reproduced with different dashes.
One presumes, yeah. Yeah. Because they were presented later. Yes. Mr. Graney, can you answer Representative Bruin's question? I don't know whether you can or not, but...
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, it's about the Energy Trust grants.
Right.
Yes. I don't know the exact number, but they are common, and we can get the exact number. I know a lot of the solar applications use them. I think most of the Energy Trust money for wind is not going to large wind projects. Currently, it's going to smaller projects, but I can verify that and get back to you.
And we heard a couple of examples from the witness just before you about how that actually fits in with the development of the project, and I think that would be helpful for us to know.
Yes, now, yes, Mr. Chairman.
In fairness to the Department of Energy, I think the idea here actually came from another source, and he's acting as a conduit for it. I don't think anyone should assume that the idea actually came from the Department of Energy. But I think it would be helpful if we could explore that question that the last witness raised, which really was, in order to build these little projects, you have to fit pieces together in order to make the whole thing pencil. And his argument was that if you take off a piece of this, then you reduce the likelihood that they'll actually be built at all. And I think that's a question that would be useful to explore.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And I think to the extent that we're driven by looking for ways to reduce the revenue impact, Mr. Wooden's suggestion of carving out smaller community-based projects to still be able to take advantage of both, for example, might be a reasonable approach.
Accepting them from the dash threes, as
yes.
it were.
Okay. Yes. I could mention one other thing, just briefly looking at these. I think the dash ones may not be doing what was intended. I think they have reduced the cap for solar manufacturing facilities from $40 million to $20 million, and I think they may have deleted entirely the credit for renewable energy generation projects. So I think this one may need to be redrafted.
We will ask Chris to take another very careful look at that. And if that's the case, we'll obviously be drafting a dash, whatever, 5, 6, 7, or 8. Representative Bruin.
Thank you. Can I move to the, since the director's here, can I move to the dash 4 real quick?
And you talk about it? Yes, please.
Yeah, just a question. We're removing the 10% miss, if you will. A project comes in and they guesstimate project costs, and we have that little. Currently, we have the 10% wiggle room. Would this allow removing that? Does the applicant have any other way to address getting a project cost wrong? I.e., can they go back and start from scratch, or are they locked into? And I ask that question, Mr. Chair, as somebody who's come from the construction world and realizing that 10% is not a very big margin of error for large construction projects.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bruin, they would have the option to modify the pre-cert, for example, and then we give them a final cert consistent with that, as long as it's under the dollar limit, the $20 million or $10 million if you adopt that lower limit. What's happening now is for the larger projects, they are, because of this provision, able to exceed that limit by 10%. So in some cases, we've had certified costs up to $22 million. For large generating facilities on the final cert.
Oh, that we're crediting, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
So they truly are crediting that
yes.
much?
Yes.
So this just says we really mean 20.
Yes.
Yeah. We don't mean any more than 20.
That's exactly right, Mr.
Chair. So this is a little different, I think, perhaps, than what you were thinking about.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay. Anything else for Mr. Graney? Probably. Thank you. We appreciate your patience sitting through this long hearing today.
Okay. I think it
was. All right. Anything else from the committee on this? Obviously, there are some additional amendments that need to be prepared. We are going to have to take another look at the dash ones and see if they've been drafted correctly. And I don't think we're going to be ready to hear this again until we're able to notice it. So we'll close the work session on House Bill 3411. Stay tuned on when this is going to come up again. I don't intend to open 2472, which I think we've superseded essentially with 3411 at this stage. And we've moved the public hearing on 3291 till tomorrow. We already announced earlier that we're going to carry over 2067 until tomorrow. So we'll carry those two over until tomorrow. And then, of course, with our regular agenda for tomorrow. And with that, the committee is adjourned.
Whoa. This is mind-numbing. Yes?